When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to The Economist Asks. I'm Anne McElvoy. There's been some progress since the hashtags OscarsSoWhite and MeToo shone a spotlight on power imbalances in Hollywood. The Academy has pledged to double women and minority members by 2020. But recent research suggests that the picture behind the scenes may be far worse than that on screen. The latest definitive Annenberg report found that only 6% of top directors in the last decade had been black, compared with 16% of lead actors. Only 3% of directors were Asian, and only 4% were women. So this week we're asking, how does the director's chair become more diverse? Chiwetel Ejiofor earned his dramatic stripes on the West End stage, with an Olivier Award-winning turn as Othello. On screen, he's played a drag queen in Kinky Boots and a Marvel supervillain in Doctor Strange. Along the way, he picked up an Oscar nomination for Best Actor as Solomon Northup in 12 Years a Slave. Having chalked all that off, he's now stepped behind the camera for the first time to direct a feature film, The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. It's the true story of William Kamkwamba, a young Malawian boy who saved his community from famine by teaching himself to build a windmill. Chiwetel Ejiofor, welcome to The Economist Asks.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So tell me why you chose this story, The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind, for your first feature as a director. One's first choice there is kind of hang around for a while. So why this one?
Yeah, I read the book coming up to 10 years ago now, and when it first came out, and I was just sort of stunned by William's story. I was sort of amazed by it on a number of different levels. I just thought it was a very rich tale, obviously very hopeful, very inspiring. You know, William Kamkwamba and his family in these very difficult circumstances, almost unimaginably hard circumstances of this flooding and then a drought, a kind of double whammy, and this potential famine in this region. And I was deeply inspired by this story. I thought it was a remarkably optimistic story. His tenacity, his striving, what it says about education, of technology and science, of progress, you know, all of these things I thought were very rich. And then I also was sort of engaged with the other layers of this story and the other layers of his sort of family dynamic, but also the sort of geopolitics, if you like, the nature of climate change, the nature of deforestation, the nature of the economic situation that he was in and that had a global impact.
You know, that very basic list of what this film is about and what it brings up and turns around just reminds me what a very unusual and challenging choice it is. Mm. You use the word rich, but you could also say this is actually a very complex things going on here, but it also has to come to life as a film. Did you have any worries about how you'd get over that hurdle, particularly on a directorial debut?
Well, I think that the process for me was one of developing the film and developing the script over a period of time and working with various people who came on board at different stages, you know, to work on the film. And so the heart of the film and working on that kind of those dynamics, those family dynamics, those interpersonal dynamics, but also then teasing out all of the kind of other layers of the film as well and working that through in a development process that took a while. And going back to Malawi a lot and going back and forth to Malawi a lot. I first went out to Malawi not long after reading the book, 2010, 2011, which is when I met William Kamkwamba. And he showed me around his village and also took me around the sort of wider region of Kasungu, which is where his family is in Malawi. And so I got started to get a bit of an understanding of the place.
And actually filming in the real village of the story is quite unusual because one frequently used short cut is for films set in Southern Africa. It's film in South Africa, which has a big film industry. It has the infrastructure in place. Why did you go a different route?
Well, I very quickly sort of wanted to have this sense of when I read the book, you know, one of the things I think for that really touched me was just that authentic dynamic, just that real sense of place and very specifically a sense of place. So for me, I was always engaged with trying to bring an audience into that kind of dynamic, into that kind of reality and that kind of authenticity to potentially have that sort of teleportation experience is how I described it back then and continue to that Alice in Wonderland slip down the rabbit hole and you're in a completely different space, but it has to be internally consistent. And so to hold the full integrity of the piece, you know, it seemed to me that it was very important to shoot in Malawi to actually be in the authentic place.
You know? I think you had to be quite creative, or your teams had to be quite skillful and creative to make that work. Any memories of that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the logistics were complicated, you know, and so we were bringing in equipment and personnel from various different places, but a lot from South Africa and a lot from Kenya. And that's, you know, crossing borders, that's all these kind of logistical time constraints, all of these things that come into play. And so, yeah, people had to be creative with that. There was some equipment that didn't arrive when we needed it. And, you know, it was stuck on some border or something else. And Dick Pope, you know, was really taking the brunt of those things as the cinematographer and being creative about things and really protecting me in many ways from having to sort of sweat about all of the sort of details of that, but wanting to get the images that we wanted to get, you know.
I'm smiling because I'm going to recommend to you a quite seminal Economist piece by my colleague Robert Guest when he was working in Africa, which is about the difficulty of getting goods across borders in Africa, in which he set off with a barrel of beer to cross a truckload of beer to sort of find out what was left of it by the time you got to it. So you will know that scenario.
No, exactly.
Up close. The young Maxwell Simba plays William, the lead character here, a non-professional leader. I think it's not really fair to say non-professional actor, because he can certainly act. But that does now seem to be part of a trend. It's there in Korn's Roma as well. Is it something that you think is particularly important to this work?
Well, not really. I mean, not in that sense. You know, not in the fact that I was selecting somebody because they hadn't acted before. I was looking at a whole host of people, and I was I would have been very delighted to choose somebody who had experience on film and whatever. But my concern and my focus was really just trying to find the right person in whatever guise that would arrive in. We were in schools auditioning people, you know, in various countries, and trying to find somebody who could really capture William Kamkwamba and his energy and his sort of tenacity, I think.
It's also made entirely in Chichewa, the language, that part of Malawi. I think we're going to hear a clip of your character preparing William for his first day at secondary school.
Omene yankata kayi kitala chenye chat se chat sanjala akola komanja pa moto wako kukutola akola komanzera yamata kupita ku school. Oyamba pomwe de na esera de na le wocha pa kwambiri. Sinde nate. Yes sir.
One Malawian writer, Rabson Kondoe, has griped a bit about accents and not hiring local actors, given that both you and Simba were from outside Malawi. What do you make of that?
Oh, well, we certainly auditioned plenty of people in Malawi, and it would have been fantastic to, you know, to have had a full cast of Malawian actors. Lily Banda, who plays Annie, is a crucial part of the film, plays my daughter in the film, is from Malawi, as is Philbert, who plays Gilbert in the film. But we couldn't cast everybody, because you are trying to cast, you know, according to the characters, and to try and cast the best people to play those parts. And sometimes that isn't as easy as when there's a major kind of acting, you know, world, you know, which there isn't actually specifically in Malawi. So we did have to reach outside of that and learn the language. And obviously that comes with slight consequence of it not being a perfect accent and so on. And there's no way that in that sort of time myself or Maxwell would have been able to do the accent perfectly. But we did do the best we can, and the hope is that people who do speak Chichewa, who are fluent in Chichewa, can also see that was the attempt to do it, to create an authentic experience for the audience who may not be as familiar with Chichewa as they are, And they might be able to sort of see past that to us really trying to deliver William Kamkwamba's story to a global audience.
Do you think audiences are becoming more open to foreign language films, particularly languages that they just won't have encountered before, not just arthouse French movies in this case? Again, Cuarón and Roma got a lot of attention that way. You obviously felt very confident that you could do this and bring a kind of audience that you would want to bring to this. Would you have felt so confident a few years ago?
I mean, maybe not. You know, I do feel that there is an appetite and a thirst for as much of an authentic experience as one can get. And that, I think, is about point of view. The telling a story and seeing a film that is inside the perspective and the point of view of the characters going through something like this, you know, is, I think, is increasingly engaging to an audience. And I think as the as sort of there's that sort of wider world of sort of streaming platforms and these kinds of stories are able to get out there and find audiences, you know, I think people are much more engaged with that kind of, you know, authentic portrayal and those authentic points of view.
And that move from acting to directing, easy bridge to cross. A lot of thought went into it, I'm sure. But I mean, is it the way that you thought it would be when you move from being on one side of the camera to the other?
Well, it's a steep learning curve. I mean, that is true. It's you know, there was a lot to sort of do, but again, I think that the process of spending the time that I had and the time that I took over several years, and that process of people coming sort of on board the film, you know, refined and detailed the script stages of the film and that development process to a point whereby, you know, one really starts to kind of understand and has several years of investment in the process at a certain point. And that does improve the kind of confidence with which one goes out to Malawi or anywhere to make the film ultimately, because you've really sat with it and investigated with various different people every aspect of the story over several years.
You gain some control, but do you lose something as well?
Well, I think it depends on who your collaborators are. You know, that the hope is, and in this case, I think it was really, really worked out in this way, that the people that you're working with have ideas that they bring to the table that aren't, you know, sort of dictating things, but are opening up areas of conversation and bringing in their own experiences and their own understanding of film and their own respect of the kind of process of that and the director's process and the writer's process and also the actor's process, you know. So it is a kind of a collaborative energy over that period of time, and that's really what we encountered, I think, and what we found.
I think there was an interview shortly after 12 Years a Slave won Best Picture award. This sort of peak, really, I suppose, sort of crowning the great success you had with that film. When you were asked quite a lot about racial bias in the industry, and I might be wrong, but I think you sometimes began to irk you because I think some of your responses suggested you'd rather talk about something else. Am I right, or has that changed?
No, I don't know. I think that it's always an important question, and I wonder. I mean, I don't know. I suppose for me, there are different times when it's more or less appropriate. You know, I've certainly been in circumstances where I felt people were just sort of angling for their own angle on, you know, that whatever piece they were writing and so on, which can be a bit annoying if it's not really a genuine investigation into what is happening or the state of the industry, but a kind of shortcut to a headline. So, but I think if there's genuine interest and a genuine conversation is possible, then I think it's a great thing to talk about.
Yeah. I think you said at the time, I can't speak on those things. I haven't thought about it that much. But now, of course, you're in a very different position. Your career has moved on. You're doing your next project. Has your view settled into anything particular, or have you come up with new challenges?
Well, I suppose in the context of racial bias, you know, that I feel like it is a societal issue, you know, racial bias. And it is something that, as is gender bias, you know, that is something that we are going to wrestle with and continue to wrestle with in order to create more equal systems of social systems and employment systems and so on. You know, it isn't something that just affects the film industry, of course. It affects things in a much more sort of wider in sort of general way.
What would you change more of, especially knowing what you know now from both both ends of the process?
Well, I think it's actually just, I think it's a process of education. You know, I think it's a process of people understanding, first of all, that there is such a thing as these kind of unconscious biases that that allow them to choose and to select people on basis that are often unconsciously, sometimes consciously as well, but sometimes, you know, and often unconsciously working in the favor of certain people over certain people. And that is something that is very much a part of our society. So I feel like that actually being aware of those things and having some focus in those things and those in that direction does positively influence the change. I have a great faith and optimism in terms of people. And I feel that when people are kind of aware of certain things, you know, that they do make adjustments in order to make things fairer on the whole. I mean, obviously, there are exceptions. But on the whole, I think people do that. And I feel like sometimes the nature of unconscious bias is that it is exactly that. And that is a very kind of insidious part of all of the conversations that, we can have.
So what's changed? Saw you in Othello. I think we worked out it was 2007. You were at the Donmar Theatre in London playing that. Absolutely, you know, still a pretty freshly minted young actor then, playing that role, fraught with questions about race.
Mm-hmm.
What's changed? And when you look back on that time, do you see different attitudes, different biases, conscious or otherwise, or anything that have actually changed?
Well, I think the conversation is becoming richer. That's what I think. That's the sort of the main thing. And I think that people are moving away a little bit from sort of this a kind of an easy fix mentality. There is no easy fix in a way, you know, that it is a concentrated effort and it's going to take a long time. It's a sort of a generational choice. You know, certain attitudes are very fixed, you know, they're very fixed attitudes and they're going to take a while to shift. And so I feel that there are times where people have kind of tried to sort of brush things under the carpet, or they've tried to kind of apply a kind of easy solution to things where if like a data solution, like if the numbers match in this way, then everything's fine. But actually, there's much more kind of underneath it that is psychological, that is about the way that bias is pervasive in the society and the way in which you, through education and through understanding and through empathy and through different cultural influences, as well as educational influences, are able to evolve points of view that then include other people in a full way. Not that you're doing something good, quote unquote, but that you are naturally engaged with other people, their lifestyles, and want them in your immediate environment.
And looking back, do you feel that there were opportunities that were denied to you because of the colour of your skin?
Well, I don't know. That's a kind of, I mean, that's a sort of, I don't know because I didn't do those roles and blah, blah, blah. So I don't know exactly. It's hard to say exactly what would be different. What I do know is that in a general context, and this is also the distinction between being a successful individual actor and trying to use that sense of being a successful individual actor to explain whether a system is beneficial or negative. I've had incredible fortune in my acting career and great moments in my acting career, but I can still say that I think the system overall is unfair to black actors, and I think that's
I was thinking about something, and you know, this is off the top of my head, and it may not at all suit your experience, but something like the male white romantic lead, which is still, it still feels like it's sort of overwhelming. You know, we've got a picture in our mind's eye of the Oscar season around us now, when we look at that at the kind of rom-com, for instance. I don't know. That's just an example.
Yeah, sure. I think there are. I mean, hundreds of those kinds of examples, absolutely, that are images that we have, that we have become accustomed to over the entire history of cinema and a lot of theatre, you know, generations of theatre, that have imprinted certain roles to be within the concepts of certain people. And that's exactly one of them, the white romantic lead. And yes, and I think that that is obviously something that that is very difficult to kind of break down. And it's not a question of just, like I say, it's not a sort of data arrangement that breaks those things down. It's actually how society evolves to include other people in that dynamic. So that is a sort of a welcomed or natural occurrence as opposed to a kind of imposed thought.
And you've worked with some of the great directors of the last decades. I'm thinking of 12 Years a Slave, Steve McQueen, Spike Lee on Inside Man. How much power do you think directors have to change the status quo? Are they stepping up to it?
I think directors have a lot of power and have a lot of influence and can very much sort of lead the conversation in several ways. But I think it's about how films are produced, the nature of the audiences that are being invited to come to the productions and to see the films or the TV shows or the plays, and the diversity of those audiences as well, and whether that's something that is actively encouraged or whether it's not particularly encouraged. And those are the sort of levels of that we can kind of play with, you know. Those are things that I think theatre has tried to push for a more diverse audience. And of course, a more diverse audience and people being actively encouraged to come to the theatre then has an effect on what those audiences want to see and who they include in that context.
Actually, you preempted my next question. Will we see you back on the stage again? I was thinking of you in fetching doublet and hose. I mean, would that still attract you now?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I always look forward to being on stage, and it's been a few years now. It's been three years, and that's always about as much as I can take of not being on stage. So I'm very much looking at getting back on stage.
What you got your eye on?
Oh, well, a couple of things. It's a bit early to say, but
there's only a few of us around, you can see.
Yeah, exactly.
Agent screaming blue murder outside. And if you went back to the National Youth Theatre, which is just such a huge spawning ground of British talent, also trying to open its doors a bit more widely, what advice would you have now for young people going into acting or directing, particularly those from underrepresented groups?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a great question. I think that the, you know, it's always that's the sort of struggle to kind of to push and to be as engaged with the work as you can be, and that nature of it being so vocational, I think, and that really the doing it is all, you know, and so really exploring those avenues. I would have encouraged myself, if I was talking to myself when I was 16, to have, you know, I was very fortunate, like I say, to be able to craft a career from a quite an early age in many ways. But I would have also encouraged myself to be sort of writing earlier and to be getting involved in the kind of production side of things as early as possible, because that is also a very it's a very strong way of taking a sizable amount of control over the kind of the product, and not just relying on that, on those kind of fortunate breaks, you know, because some people get them, some people don't. But, you know, you can be sort of left by the wayside a tiny bit if you're not sort of actively involved in things. And I think that that would probably be the advice I'd give myself.
Multi-skill.
Multitask, yeah, multitask.
Multilingual as well.
Exactly.
Chautal Ejiofor, thank you very much for joining us
thank
today.
Thank you, pleasure.
And The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind is on Netflix from March the 1st. So, what do you reckon? Can the director's chair be democratised? And how will that change what we all see on the silver screen? Write to us, radio@economist.com, or tweet us at Economist Radio. And please do take a moment to rate us on Apple Podcasts. I'm Anne McElvoy, and in London, this is The Economist.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.